I think of how many of us here today and throughout the world, if we think back, would we be here? Would we be practicing these techniques were it not for this disciple of Master and his efforts? You know, there's a reason Swamiji so often tells that story that Ramakrishna told of the three men climbing into the garden of cosmic consciousness and the two who stayed and never came back and the one who did. When I arrived the other day and Padma and I greeted Swamiji and he revealed to us he's working on whispers, I have to admit I was a bit shocked. But he spoke, as he did yesterday, about the exuberance of Master's love for all souls. And you know the patterns in the great spiritual families of the avatars, they keep repeating and repeating. Swamiji's often said, quoting Master, quoting the Shastras, that all of Krishna's soldiers were like Krishna. It doesn't deny our unique individuality, but there are patterns, you might say, in which we all follow. And if Kali Yuga is the winter of human consciousness, surely Dwapara is the spring. And it's the time for the, you might say, the buds of divine consciousness to blossom in the garden of this earth paradise from our hearts. There is a great work to do. Master said repeatedly that Swamiji has a great work to do, and obviously he's done it, and he continues to do it. But he can't do it except as himself, as an instrument, through you and I. These stories and these patterns keep repeating. I think of, you know, I got hold of a magazine in 1952. We have a collection of them published by Self-Realization Fellowship. And in their magazine, it may have been in the local newspapers now, I don't recall, but in the magazine was a news report of that garden party, July 31st, 1949. By that account, there were 800 people there when Master gave that thundering call to arms, as it were, the imprinting into the ether, as he put it, the great work of communities, one and only one step forward, the young Walter, soon to become Swami Kriyananda, to help manifest that dream. You know, when Yogananda was campaigning in the days of the 20s and 30s, thousands came. Sometimes they had to do two lectures in a night to accommodate people here in America. And so naturally his friends and so forth would congratulate him for the great swelling audiences. But one time, standing in the wings before he was about to go to speak, being so congratulated, he turned and he said, "Yes, but you know, perhaps one will come and take up the spiritual life." And I have no doubt that he was correct in that. There are not many, and yet look at all of us gathered here. It is a great work to do, and these patterns continue. I think of coming here to Ananda, and Swami was out lecturing somewhere. In fact, I think he may have been in India when I first arrived, and somebody handed me a cassette tape, and our friend Ganesha here would record these talks up at the old retreat using car batteries. And so, you know, the tapes were, well, let's just say funky. And so my introduction to Swami Kriyananda was sort of this chipmunk-type voice. And boy, he sounds awfully young. But still, one could feel the great wisdom in that. Somebody, well, I want to, before I go there, I think too, you know, Master fled to the Himalayas, didn't he, several times. And there's this conversation he reports with Sri Yukteswar, his guru, in which Sri Yukteswar confronted Master as a young monk, Swami Yogananda, confronted him and asked why he was so, you might say in our language, so down on spiritual work, spiritual service, organization, and so forth. And Master said he didn't reply, but he vowed in his heart, as I know, as Swamiji said he did on that day in July in 1949, he vowed to carry forward that work. There are not many. Many have, and Swami has also, made the comparison to the life of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus. One man, really, one man set into motion the work of Jesus separately. It was St. Paul. It could have easily have been consigned to the dustbin of scholarly footnotes of some strange, perhaps cult or something, would no doubt have been described had it remained in Jerusalem with the few disciples. One man, it is so often that. And yet, by contrast, Swamiji also frequently tells that of that story of his encounter with a great soul, a liberated soul, Sri Ramayogi in southern India, not of our lineage and so forth, but a great soul with whom he felt deep, deep attunement, would have, had he stayed, as Master said himself of the same meeting, if he had stayed, he perhaps would not have come back. Yet what Swami reports in that meeting was that he asked Sri Ramayogi, why, essentially, are you not doing anything? You're not teaching anyone. You don't seem to have any disciples. Some old fellow who was a relative of his, perhaps, hanging about the ashram. And he said, well, God has done what he wants through this body. When young Walter, when he was asked by Master to write articles for the magazine in those early years, tried to enlist some of the older disciples, they responded with an astounding silence. For you see, it isn't necessarily for everyone. But we are Master's children, grandchildren in some ways, and Swamiji is our spiritual father. I'm not sure I could have found this path, and even if I did, I know for sure that the blessings we've all received through the work of Swamiji is without measure. The opportunities to serve in ways, in many ways, some obvious, invisible, but most invisible in our hearts, because that's really where it counts. There are many things we could say of Swamiji and so forth, but I know what he would like us to affirm, of course, is what it means to us and how we too can follow in his footsteps. Someone once asked, we had our first video conference a couple of weeks ago in Seattle after Swamiji just landed here. He was in Palo Alto, and we had a little fundraising luncheon there in Seattle, and he spoke to us, and one of our members asked Swamiji a question commonly asked, actually, and more commonly by all of us cogitated upon, which is, did Master go through all these trials and tests and lessons that he speaks of in the autobiography? Was that just a show for our benefit? Certainly it is for our benefit, there's no question about that, but what was his role in those lessons? Yesterday, Swamiji answered that beautifully, explaining that Master as an avatar with nothing, you might say, in his karmic makeup, if you want to call it that, nothing compelling, could easily play the roles with complete freedom. I'm not the only one in here today who has probably scratched our noggins about how we could integrate and understand Master's claim that he was William the Conqueror in a prior life. That's a hard act to swallow. And what could that mean? And in the book Conversations with Yogananda, Swamiji, and I think back to those times and I think, boy, was he audacious, the questions he asked Master. And though he was in awe of him, it didn't seem to stop him from just pounding him with questions. And I think we are all eternally grateful. But one of the questions was essentially that. How can you explain that? And what I recall of it, which is meaningful to me, was he said, such a one, no matter what role he has to play, never loses his sense of inner freedom. And that's the quality I'd like just to comment a little bit about. It's that sense of freedom that I've always felt in Swamiji. You know, there was a time he puttered around the community on a motorbike, and he'd do arm wrestling with the men and leg wrestling and pool fights and so forth. I mean, there are many such stories one could tell. He's talked about how he looks in at his own photograph as a child and says, oh, it's the same old fellow. And it's an interesting dilemma that we all face. Who am I? Do we progress spiritually? Yes. Are we always the soul? Yes. How do we connect the two dots somehow? I look at, for example, his autobiography, Swamiji's, that is, The Path. And I cannot but go back to it and see what beautiful writing. I mean, you know, Yogananda's autobiography is a classic of literature in its own right, quite apart from its content and its vibration. And yet, I find that same quality in the path, the rhythm of the writing, the deep wisdom, the joyful sense of humor. I think of he and the monks riding in a pickup truck with their shirts off, practicing du-mo, tu-mo, you know, endurance and so forth. And you feel the joy, as it were, of the early years. And that joy he shared with us. If we became too fanatical, perhaps, as we tended to be around, you know, silly issues, really, in spiritual terms, maybe health food, he'd pull out the sugar cookies and pass them around, and you know, all that, they all disappeared. He's invited us, inspired us, and challenged us in so many ways. I don't have much time, but I think of one way in which he challenged us, and it's a more of a humorous way. Occasionally, I would accompany Padma and the Crystal Clarity team to these book shows, and in those years, Swamiji often went because he was writing like a fiend. If you think he writes a lot now, you should have seen him then every few weeks. Sometimes out come another book, and so he'd go, and it was so delightful. He had doing a lot of music at that time, and in his own quiet way, he would show us. You know, we weren't very good salespeople. We didn't want to bother anybody after all, and. So he'd step out of the Crystal Clarity booth and some passerby, and he'd say, "Would you like to hear some music?" And so he'd put the headphones on them, and he was just so childlike and so natural, and he just saw everyone as his own friend. And one time we were having lunch, and you know at those trade shows, it's crowded and so forth, and so you share your lunch table with God knows who. And so in our little lunch table, Padma and I were sitting there, and some fellow from China shows up, and a bit stuffy, you know, and Swamiji is so engaging. He just immediately fired up a conversation and so on, and then he proceeded to tell what was a joke, but I just melted in my seat. You know, it was so seemingly politically incorrect, and I can't repeat the joke. I don't have time, but it had to do with imitating a Chinese accent on the subject of languages and attunement to languages. And so, you know, it was one of these ah so kinds of conversations. And I was just like this, you know. But it was so childlike, and it was so sincere, and it was just so transcendent of the kind of consciousness that would take offense at that how could this man except just laugh delightedly? In the waiting room just a few months ago, when Padma and I had the opportunity to be there in Delhi, it just happened to be during these surgeries that he underwent, and sitting in this tiny, crowded little waiting room, and there were some Muslim men sitting there, and Swamiji just again struck up a conversation and asked if they knew the Bhagavad Gita, and, you know, I'm thinking, oh, geez, you know, and yes, 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 you know, and then right away he starts singing one of the Bengali chants so sweetly, and this man, sort of his face softened, and he knew the chant, "Will that day come to me, Ma?" And so in this crowded waiting room, there they were chanting this together. I mean, I just about melted in my seat in a different way this time. And at the end, he just, as he does, he pulled out his little Gita and offered it to them. And he was so, so touched. Who knows? It's just a seed, but such a seed. That freedom you see in his eyes. You know, we all go through the stages of life as he and we do. Now he's in a stage of life where none of the earthly duties and compelling aspects of his dharma, really they all have a back seat. He can shine through that bliss, which it's always been there. When people sometimes say to me, well, you know, maybe he's, you know, come along in this, that, and the other way. Well, it's not my place to imagine or judge such a thing. But when I think back, that sense of freedom, that sense that Master gave to us of accepting our humanity while affirming and deepening our realization of our divinity seamlessly, whether in play or under trials and tribulations and persecutions, always the same. Always those eyes deep and calm. At the hospital there, I'll end on this note. we were allowed to go in into the recovery room, forget what they call it now, but intensive care unit, one at a time only. So when it was my turn, I walked in there, and it was a serious operation and so on. His eyes were glowing. He was, you know, it was difficult. It's not a denial of discomfort, pain, maybe even anxiety, though there was no trace of it in my awareness. But still, I walked up to him, lying on his bed. He reached out his hands, and what a lion grip. And he said, "How are you? How are things in Seattle?" It's like, "Swamiji, how are you?" But that's the story of his life. Like the buds of spring of Dwapara, he's teaching us a new way of life. He referred to Sadhu Beware. It's a little book. It's so practical. And yet it contains the germ, the seeds of a new form of monasticism, a new form of renunciation. But it's renunciation in joy. It's an investment in creativity. He's given us so many lessons. But I think that one thought I'd like to share with you today, when I see him, whenever I see him, when I read his books, listen to his voice, I feel that freedom. What a gift. What an invitation. And I know I speak for all of us in saying how grateful we are.